maybe we'll each of us will just introduce ourselves first. I'm Jack Nelson Palmeyer.
I'm Sarah Nelson Palmeyer.
I am Maria Luisa.
Maria Luisa. And we're going to basically try to just have a conversation rather than make a big presentation. But just to get things started, Sarah's going to say a few words about what we were doing during our 2 years of work in Central America, who we were working for, what the nature of our work was. I'm going to give a two-minute history of El Salvador and Nicaragua. And Luisa is going to just tell a little bit of her story. She is now in sanctuary here in the States. And then we're going to open it up for, obviously this is not a broad-based perspective of all the different views on Central America, but we thought it might be interesting for people to have a chance to ask questions based on our experiences. So Sarah, why don't you go ahead and start.
First I'll say don't time Jack when he starts his
two-minute history.
Don't time me either. I didn't say how much time I take. Jack and I were living in Central America for 2 years, from 1984 to 1986. We came home to the States about a year ago, actually a year ago, June. And we were working with an organization called the Center for Global Education. I think some of you may know about it. It's an organization out of Augsburg College in Minneapolis. And the purpose of the center is to do global education, both in Minnesota on global issues, but also for people from around the country and also from other parts of the world to experience other parts of the world. So most of all, we do travel seminars to Central America and the Caribbean. And we've also done several to the Philippines, and we've tried to do some to the Mideast, but people always get scared. There's something that happens a couple weeks before the trips, and so people decline from the trips. But anyway, when we were working in Central America, we lived in Managua, Nicaragua, and our purpose was twofold, I'd say. Both, one, to really get to understand the country, and we did a lot of traveling in order to do that and getting around, and also to help others understand the country a little bit. So we would coordinate travel seminars. Groups of about 20 at a time would come to the country, and we would help coordinate their trip. So it would range from buying food and setting up appointments with people from a wide variety of perspectives in the country, to translating, to just helping people through the experience once they came. So maybe that's enough.
Okay. You gonna time me? Time me in.
All right, you're ready?
He's coming.
Are you doing 2 minutes on each country or all together?
I'm gonna try to do it all together. 2 minutes.
Go.
Okay. Thanks for the, no. The I would just say, point out a couple of things. I think the history of Central America has, by and large, been a history of domination. And that history, you could say, began with the conquest when the Spanish essentially came in to Nicaragua, to El Salvador and other countries. With the conquest came the theft of resources, basically the theft of land. The systems that grew out of that involved a lot of near slave labor. The land became in the hands of a few people and was utilized for the production of coffee. Later on, other commodities were introduced, such as bananas. In the 1950s, cotton. But with every introduction of a new export crop came the marginalization or the victimization of the majority of the people, pushed off the land, etc. So that's kind of the history. I would say it's one of the worst areas of the world in terms of U.S. involvement, that we have a long history of backing repressive governments in the region. One of those was the family dictatorship in Nicaragua that ruled the country from 1934 to 1979, pretty much with U.S. support all the way until the Carter administration, a couple of months before the fall of Somoza, cut off military aid, only to have that military aid continue through a private network of Secord and Singlob and Hakim and many of the people who are involved in the present Iran controversy. El Salvador's history, is very similar. A long history of dictatorships, a long history of the people's aspirations being thwarted, and a long history of struggle within the people trying to bring about changes in their society, trying to bring about land reform, trying to take power in ways that would share. As you are probably aware, at present time, Nicaragua is now free of a U.S.-backed dictatorship. The United States has more or less committed itself to trying to destabilize and overthrow the present government. You've probably heard the term Sandinistas. They take their name from Sandino, who was a national hero who fought against the U.S. Marine occupation back in the 20s and 30s. And within El Salvador, you have a broad-based popular movement that is quite opposed to the present government, as well as an armed struggle going on in El Salvador to try to depose a present U.S.-backed government that was elected by democratic means, and yet somewhere along the way we'll probably talk about whether or not there in fact is a democracy in El Salvador. There's been a long history of repression. The church is very much targeted in El Salvador, and that maybe is a good lead-in to Luisa's own story.
Excuse me, can you clarify this?
It's, yeah.
I don't recall, my history is too rusty recently. It's the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. What's the other
That's
camp?
Right.
What's the other camp?
Well, the Contras are fighting against the Sandinistas. The U.S. is backing the Contras. In El Salvador, you have an armed group. The U.S.-backed government is the president, it's Duarte, who is the Christian Democratic Party. And the armed group operating there is the FMLN, the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front. And then there's also a political arm to those groups that are fighting, which is called the FDR. Okay, with just that brief background, again, you can ask other questions as we get going, but we'll ask Luisa, who is a Salvadoran refugee living here in the United States, just to tell a little bit about her story. We have not ever done this together before, so we're as interested in you.
I'm not always afraid to speak up in English, though. I have problems to understand, so just raise your hand.
Probably just as loud as you can,
yeah.
That'll be the biggest problem.
Well, we came here in 1984. I have 10 brothers and sisters, and we live in Sanctuary, as he said, in Spokane. And the reason why we came, why we left El Salvador, was because we were really involved with the church, working with the base Christian community. We worked with Monsignor Romero since 1975 through 1980. Monsignor Romero was a bishop in El Salvador, and fortunately he was kind of like elected from the campesinos, from the base Christian community. And and he was, as we say, a prophet of voice of the people who didn't have any voice in El Salvador. So he speak up for us, which now we are talking for him. This is his. We said that we have seen his resurrection in each one of us after he was killed. And in 1983, my dad was killed. So we had to leave because we had a lot of persecution from the government just by working with the Christian community.
Could you say a little bit more about how your dad was killed?
Well, he had persecution. He was threatened since 1980 when Monsignor was killed. And so we had to run away from one place to another. Since 1973, we lived with my uncle, who's a priest. We lived there and working with, doing the same work with the church. And so one of those days, the soldiers came about 11 o'clock at night and took him away, which we never found his body anymore. But he was killed.
Okay, with that very brief introduction, we're just going to open it up for any kind of, obviously Central America is in the news a lot. You can ask us questions about the situation. Yes, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you could explain a little bit more of the history surrounding the overthrow of the Somoza government, because I'm trying to understand why there is the current conflict between the Sandinista Santa Cruz. My understanding is that they were all working together against the Somoza government, and after the overthrow, then the Sandinista arm pretty much assumed total control and then did not set up a free form of government. I wonder if you comment on that.
Right. Okay. I'll respond to that. First of all, I think it's very important to understand that there is a whole lot of different groups and factions and competing interests in Nicaragua. It's not just the Contras and the Sandinistas. The Sandinistas are now the largest political party in Nicaragua. They won the elections of 1984 with about 67% of the vote in elections that were basically, according to international observers, fair and free elections. And I think pretty well reflect the degree of support the Sandinistas had in November of 1984. Leading up to the ouster of Somoza, you had a situation in which increasingly, particularly after an earthquake that took place in 1972, growing dissatisfaction with Somoza in Nicaragua. Now keep in mind that Somoza basically ran the country for the interests of the few. The vast majority of people were landless, had no access to credit, etc. So that you had, among the poor, you had a long historical dissatisfaction with Somoza. Among the upper and middle classes, Somoza was very good at co-opting or including segments of the rich within his kind of empire. But after the earthquake of 1972, a lot of aid started coming into Nicaragua, and Somoza was siphoning off a lot of that aid. He was getting very greedy. He was cutting out even many of his rich partners. So there was a broad-based movement began to develop in Nicaragua, so that by the time that Somoza was in fact ousted, most of the people in the country were opposed to Somoza. Now, it's very important to understand, however, that just because you could unite against a dictatorship didn't mean that there was necessarily unity in terms of where the direction of the society should go. And so, for example, I'll just talk about a couple of competing interests. One was you had a group called COSEP. COSEP is the largest one of the most powerful and a very large elite business organization, the Supreme Council of Private Enterprise. We know many of the people in that organization, and our trips would have meetings with them. Essentially, this is my perspective, essentially what they wanted was they wanted to get rid of Somoza, but they wanted the Somoza system to go on. In other words, they didn't want to reorient priorities and educate the poor. They didn't want a land reform that in fact would redistribute land. They didn't want popular-based health programs. They wanted basically to control the country in a way that was very similar. So you had a lot of rivalry about the direction that a revolution should go. The vast majority of people in Nicaragua supported the Sandinista program, which was essentially focused on three things. I was mentioning them real briefly. Healthcare, and tremendous progress was made in the first couple of years in relation to health, education, including a literacy crusade that won all kinds of international awards, and land reform, giving land to the campesinos so that in the time of Somoza there were only like 16,000 farm families that got credit for agriculture. Today in Nicaragua about 120,000 to 130,000 farm families get credit from the bank for agriculture. So that's a little background into why you have. But just to point out what Sarah said again, there's lots of different factions in Nicaragua. You had seven political parties that participated in the Nicaraguan elections. And what very few people know is where the Sandinistas get pushed a lot in Nicaragua is from the Communist Party and the Marxist-Leninist Party, who say that it is a bourgeois revolution protecting the interests of private property, all kinds of pressure from the left. It's also important to point out that those parties got a total of 2% in the Nicaraguan election, which I think reflects pretty well the kind of support they have in the society. In other words, the Sandinistas are a moderate party within a revolutionary situation.
What direction do the campesinos want to go? The poor.
Why don't you say something about you in your own in Salvador, and then maybe
I didn't hear.
The question was, what direction do the campesinos want to go? What do the campesinos want in El Salvador, for example?
Well, and that was a group of campesinos since 1977, and they were working with different group of peoples, and which they were working with the same process of base Christian community. And what they wanted is, the way it started in El Salvador was that they didn't have enough salary, was mm-hmm. that wasn't enough for them. And the families couldn't afford to send their son or daughter to school. And they didn't have a house. Sometimes they have to move from one place to another because they were kicked them out and all the things. So they got together and talked and say, let's see what we can do in order to have what we need. And what we need is compassion and love from others. And so they talk and they built this community, which was coordinated from Monsignor Romero. And this group of campesinos started working, but the answer was death. And so they couldn't do anything. So many of them were killed. So actually what they want is support, not just from the people in El Salvador, but from people from all over the world.
So what you're saying is that they were wanting fairer wages, and they were wanting support, and that what they got instead from the government, the response they got was bullets.
Yeah, and the answer was, you are a communist. Why? Because you're asking for support, and because you're asking for love from others. So that was the answer. Gun. We'll kill you because you're communist.
In Nicaragua, I would say it's similar. Sarah, you might want to respond to that too. That the campesino, it just simply translates as person of the land, but the irony is that they're almost always landless. So that, I mean, what campesinos have been demanding and wanting in their deepest aspiration in life is to have a piece of land that is secure for them. So that one of the things you see in Nicaragua is that you see a land reform that is giving secure titles to people. Now, it's also very interesting in Nicaragua that with the land reform program there, the government, I think, made some interesting mistakes in terms of its initial land reform. That the Nicaraguan government had in its mind, what we really need to do is we need cooperative agriculture. And there are a lot of historical reasons why that makes some sense, because you end up with a situation like Mexico where land gets divided and divided and divided until you end up with a little tiny piece of land that doesn't support you. But in response to the demands of campesinos saying, we would rather have secure title to our own piece of land, that's what the Nicaraguan government is essentially doing now. It's still encouraging the people to form cooperatives to get their seeds, to get their tools, sometimes to sell their product, to get their credit, just to streamline the agricultural system. But in fact, what they're getting now is they're getting land with secure titles. I think that's the thing that most that campesinos.
Yeah, that's what they're doing now in El Salvador. They have
cooperatives,
yeah. And they work together, and they'd rather work do their own work all by themselves, and we're going to do this land and share what we can each other, but we don't have any participation from anyone else.
What political regime supports that?
What
political group supports that? I mean, is in favor of that?
In El Salvador?
In El Salvador.
Well, they don't have any support from the government, so that means that they have to support each other. Well, they are different.
There isn't any party or any group that...
Well, I would say in Nicaragua there is. And I think, no, not for, I mean, for the most part, the parties that have been allowed to function in El Salvador don't have this as a focus, as helping the campesinos. Some of the groups that have had their leaders killed and missing, disappeared, and that sort of thing. I just wanted to say, though, that I think your question is a really important one, and I don't think many of us in the United States ask that question very much, is what would be the best thing for the poor, and what are the poor crying for? What are they asking for? And I think, and we have to see again in Nicaragua that the poor, basically, let's say the people of the land are half the population. The other half lives in the city. But most of the people that are in the city are also poor. And they are the ones, for the most part, that have elected the Sandinistas into power. You know, 1984, as Jack said again, there were elections. And the Sandinistas won 67% of the popular vote. And by the way, the popular vote was much higher than our elections.
Something around 85% of the eligible voters voted in the election.
Yeah, which is phenomenal. So those people, basically, they have voted in the Sandinistas. And I think it's important for us to remember that that was their choice, the choice of the people of that country. And we actually should respect that.
Okay, there's a number of hands. I got one here, one
here,
one here.
His was up first, I think.
There was a question asked, but I don't believe that we really got an answer to it. We are told, at least through the media that we read in this country, that just exactly the story that he said, that is that somehow or other those who are now representing the Contras were not given that fraction of responsibility of running the government, for example, as they received in the elections, and that in fact the Sandinistas took over total control of the country as opposed to the 67% and allowed them no voice. Would you respond to that, please?
Yeah, first of all, I think it's important to understand, at least this is my perspective, and it may not be the most accurate one, but I think there's very little question that the Contras are a creation of the United States. If you were, I would encourage some of you, you've heard about this, at least a few of you have. There's a video out now through the Kristic Institute that deals with who is the network behind ContraGate. Who is Secord? Who is Singla? But it is, so I'll get back to it. Because where it gets back to is that this network of people that went before the congressional committees and never got asked any of the right questions, in fact, was a network that after the Carter administration cut off the aid to Somoza, in fact, kept the military hardware flowing to Somoza. Somoza was still ousted a few months later, and immediately this network started the formation of the Contras. And they did it out of, first of all, the former Somoza National Guard, which was a very repressive national army that was in service to Somoza. They are still, according to a congressional study, 46 of the top 48 military leaders of the Contras our former National Guard. So their key leadership comes from that sector. Then you have, I'll give you one example. You've got some small landowner or campesinos who are fighting with the Contra, who for one reason or another, in part maybe in response to the early stage of the land reform that was pushing cooperatives, in part because of tremendously sophisticated propaganda, in part because the economic crisis in Nicaragua is extremely severe and they're now getting paid about $300 a month, etc. But the point I'm trying to make here is that, again, the earlier point of how the competing interests within Nicaragua, just because you get rid of a dictator. And I think the reality is that the United States is essentially backing groups of people who were alienated by the Nicaraguan Revolution because it meant for them a loss of power and control. But that does not answer the question of where do the majority of people stand in relation to Nicaragua. In other words, you can't carry out a revolution in ways that aren't going to affect the interests of some groups. But if you're asking me, was there a systematic cutting out and a usurping of power on the part of the Sandinistas, I would say absolutely not. I would say that very much in general, the priorities that the Sandinistas have pushed explain why they had the popular support that they had in the elections of 84.
Just in addition to that, you talked about the elections and how some of these people weren't allowed, and the Sandinistas took over their power. That's not true. There was a small group of people who chose not to participate in the elections. And some of those people would be the same ones that are in the Contra factions right now. And they, in fact, the government of Nicaragua switched the entry date. You could still, what's the call? I can't think of the word in English, but you could still sign up for elections.
Register
three different times. And they kept pushing back the date so these people would join. And finally, the last minute, at the very end, when it was like 6 weeks before their planned elections, they finally said, okay, you've decided not to register, that's the last chance we're going to give you, because we've got to get on with our elections, we've got to print the ballots, we've got to do et cetera. And so they never participated. It wasn't that any power was taken away from them, they chose not to.
Furthermore, and very interesting, the Conservative Party, which came in second place in the elections, which is very, very critical of the Sandinistas, you talk to their leadership and they will tell you that the U.S. Embassy tried to bribe them out of the elections, tried to pay them to not run, because they knew they were trying to discredit Nicaragua's elections. And we were successful in getting Arturo Cruz to not run. But I would say the reason Arturo Cruz didn't run was because Arturo Cruz was not going to do very well. And it made much, much better propaganda to have Arturo Cruz pull out and say, we don't have freedom and fair elections. Or not pull out, but not register for the elections. Yeah, you're in there.
The question I have, is there a legal court right here where El Salvadorians or Nicaraguans can come into the country? And also, can you tell me a little bit about sanctuaries? I don't really, you know, I've never been in contact with any of them.
I'll repeat it for everyone so everyone can hear. She was wondering if there's a quota on the Salvadorans who can enter the country or other refugees or Nicaraguans. And also she wants to know a little bit more about sanctuary. So we'll...
Okay, quota?
Quota, yeah.
A number of people that can come, a certain limit.
Well, I don't think we have the number of people who can come, because people in El Salvador, when they just can't help it, and they just cannot be there anymore, we just leave. And that's the only way we can escape from dying, by leaving the country. And it's not because, that's one point, that it's not because we want to escape from dying, but because by coming here, we help people to understand more about the situation in El Salvador and Central America. And so I don't think there is a certain number of people who come to El Salvador, there's not a group of people who can't. Because everyone who just feel like cannot be in El Salvador anymore come. But when they can, but many people can't even afford to live from El Salvador because they have no money. They don't even have a house to live. So they stay there and wait until the army came and pick them up, kill them. So some can come to the United States and some just stay there. So there's no limit.
But legally they're not allowed here.
Yeah, not legally. We just come here
tell
against
the law. Between your country and the other country.
Yeah.
I might be able to clarify that some. My name is Christian Westford. I'm from Spokane, an acronym of sanctuary ministry there. There is a law, a United States law, called the Refugee Act of 1980 that states if you leave your country for reasons that you're afraid of yourself, for political reasons or religious reasons, then you can come into the United States. It's a part of our Constitution, a part of our national body of law. So Salvadorans, people coming from any other country for reasons of persecution, legally are entitled to asylum, and that's what's called political asylum in this country. There is quotas and numbers that the INS has for people who are emigrating to this country for economic reasons. In the case of El Salvadorians, people applying at the border for the asylum status were routinely just denied and sent back into Mexico or into El Salvador, to sometimes death. And it was that breakdown of American law and the enforcement of American law by this administration, our INS, that led to the formation of the sanctuary, saying that if we're not going to recognize that these people are being persecuted in the countries that they're coming from because of the just incredible financial shots in the arm that we send to the Salvadoran government to persecute their people, that should be awfully embarrassing for us to let, say, 500,000 Salvadorans enter our country because they've been tortured in their country. So instead, they're just refused. And that's why sanctuary.
And I'd also like to add to that, too. I'm also from Spokane Sanctuary. I'm Chris's sister, Becky. I'd like to add to that the history of sanctuary, how sanctuary was started. It was started by a man named John Fife, and in a small community with him. And he started out, a friend of his accidentally picked up a Salvadorian who was hitchhiking, and he was driving John Fife's car. And the car was pulled over, and the Salvadorian was arrested. And he came home and told John Fife this, and they talked about it, and they went down to try to discover what happened to this man. What they discovered were many, many, many refugees in the same situation. And so they tried for the first 2 years legally to bond these refugees, to follow them through, to apply for asylum with them, to do everything within the law, our law, to bond these and to help these refugees. And what they were finding was that to no avail, that eventually these refugees were being deported, and that there were so many that they could not possibly do it in this fashion. And that was when they started taking them before they were arrested. And that was when sanctuary, as we have it now, started.
I think it's about 2% or 3% of Salvadorans who apply for refugee status or asylum who receive it. It's about 1% of Guatemalans. And the reality is that you have to be persecuted from a country in order to get asylum. And the reason that we don't accept them is because the United States is unwilling to deal with the reality that they are coming from government. In the case of El Salvador, they're coming from countries that the United States is the principal backer of. So it's clearly a political decision.
And once a family is in a sanctuary, can they eventually become a legal alien?
No, that's the process we're talking about. If you go through the process, that only 2 or 3% of them are actually winning that. So the rest of them are here illegally.
Yeah.
You can't work them, and they can't.
Not legally.
Can they legally get through the border, and then they just can't do anything?
No, they illegally get past the border guards. There is another program. There's another program called the Overground Railroad that Sarah and I are a part of. Do you want to explain that? Why don't you explain that?
Well, the Overground Railroad is when people get picked up or detained in Texas, for example, and then are put in detention centers. And then an organization or a church group or some other committee of people will pay for their bond, will pay to get them out. So they're out legally until they go before trial, and when a judge will, and during that time you're trying to get a case built that they had to come for political reasons and for their own safety, for their lives. And also the Overground Railroad, because for most of them they're trying to get to Canada, because the Canadian government has been accepting far more of these people than the United States government. So, for example, we have two Guatemalans living at our home right now, and they are they're trying to get asylum both in Canada and the United States at the same time. And whichever one would come first, more than likely Canadian, they would go on to Canada.
They have about a 67% chance of being accepted into Canada, although that's starting to close down a little bit, but it's been.
Don't get accepted for the asylum. Well, their options at that point are to do a border presentation to Canada, or go underground, or go back, or even try a border presentation to another country.
There's another group of refugees, too, that don't fall into either one of those classes. There are some that they won't accept for asylum. What they do is give them a work permit that leaves them in limbo. They can stay in a semi-limbo status for years and years. There are a lot of Afghanistan and Iranian refugees in particular that have that status. There are a few of those also, and what happens is the government authorizes them for a work permit for a period of time, and technically they're reviewing their application for asylum, but they never get beyond giving them the work permit. They have no other rights.
Yeah, you had your hand up.
Daniel Ortega is obviously a very smart fellow. I was wondering if either one of you could comment on why he really does dumb political things. Right before the Congress will vote on the contrary, he goes to visit Moscow. And things like that.
It seems like that's an attitude that a lot of people in the States have, that Daniel Ortega, boy, he really blows it a lot. And I think, on the other hand, there's two things. One is, I don't think so that he really does that. And I can give some information, for example, on the Moscow bull event. But others is that his main goal, I mean, the country of Nicaragua is trying to be a sovereign country. It's well aware of the fact that it's in the Western Hemisphere and the United States is the dominant force in this hemisphere. But on the other hand, its major goal in existence is not to please the United States. Just like our major goal is not to please Nicaragua or any other country, our major goal is to further ourselves. And so I think we have to see that Nicaragua has the same sovereign, I can't even say it's the same, but it's got its own sovereignty, and that's what it thinks about first. Now, in regard to the trip to the Soviet Union, for example, I think a lot of information never really got to us about that trip. But when we've asked him about that, we've talked to him, we've asked him about that, we got a lot more information, and others have verified this, and other people in our Congress even, that Daniel Ortega, in 1985, there was a vote whether or not the United States should give aid to the Contra. This was in April. And the United States Congress voted no, that we should not. 2 days later, Daniel Ortega left for the Soviet Union, and everyone said, wow, that was a slap in our face. How could he do that to us? Well, the truth behind it was a couple things. One is that Nicaragua at that time was extremely low in oil. They had none, basically. And they knew it wasn't going to last 30 days from that point on. 2 weeks earlier, or 2 weeks or so earlier, Daniel Ortega had gone to some senators and congresspeople in the United States and talked to him and said, I just want you to know, I know the vote for the aid is coming up and I'm concerned about that, but we are out of oil and we are desperate. I'm going to go to the Soviet Union. The trip is going to be in about 2 weeks. I'll tell you the date I'm leaving, and so you're well aware of that fact. Well, that news never got out to the United States people. Those senators knew 2 weeks before the date he left that he was going to do it. It turned out, you know, as always, we don't know exactly when we're going to vote on these issues, and our Congress sometimes puts things off for a day or two. It turned out that the timing really stunk, and it was like a day or two after the vote that he left. But a lot of people knew about it. Furthermore, when he went to that trip, he also knew, and he also told people, I'm going to do a whole European, Western European and Eastern European and Soviet tour in order to get some money and aid. And so he went to the Soviet Union, and he went to other Eastern Bloc countries, I think Yugoslavia, a couple. He also went to a lot of other countries, such as Norway, Sweden, etc. The interesting thing is he raised $402 million on his trip. Anybody know where that money came from? How did it divide up?
Most of it was from Norway, or about 30% or 40% from Norway.
Well, about $202 million came from the Western European countries, $200 million came from the Soviet Union and the Eastern countries. So it was split basically down the middle. But most, you know, in the press that we got, and we all read that in Central America, everyone knew it. But we got reports from the papers here, and hardly any papers here reported that. So that's just one example of things that, you know, we get half the story and we get really mad.
Just one other thing to add to that is that part of the timing of that trip was Daniel Ortega was invited by Olof Palme of Sweden to receive an award. And so he traveled to Sweden on that trip. That was part of the timing. When you're a little country of less than 3 million people that's basically bankrupt, you don't fly overseas every other week. You coordinate your trips. So I think the point of that story for me is not that Daniel Ortega does stupid political things. It's who's manipulating the news in what interest in this country. I think those are the key questions. Okay, we got all kinds of hands. Yours has been up for quite a while.
I was wondering, we do hear a lot from the press that there's a lot of communist influence in government. Now, if I'm understanding you correctly, there isn't.
Okay, let me comment on that. The question was, we hear that there's a lot of...
And in fact, that there's supposed to be Cuban mercenaries, which are, of course, linked to Russia.
Okay. He said that there's a lot of talk here about the communist influence in Nicaragua. Are we saying that there is none? In fact, we hear about Cuban mercenaries, and that, of course, is a link to Russia. So, very big issue, but I'll try to respond as briefly as I can. First of all, just to tell you, Nicaragua says that its whole philosophy of survival, as Sarah said, is to stand on four legs, or what they say is diversify their dependency. They had a history of being dependent on one country, the United States. And the United States was able to basically control the economic and political decisions in Nicaragua. So they said, we want to stand on four legs. Well, what makes up the four legs? They want good relationships with the United States. Well, that's a pretty crippled leg right now. They want good relationships with Western Europe and Canada. And in fact, there are thousands, and I don't think many people in this room know, there are thousands of Western Europeans and Canadians who are working with the Nicaraguan government and the Nicaraguan people in their revolution. And that, in fact, the majority of economic aid since 1979 has, in fact, come from Western European countries and the non-aligned countries. Okay, another leg they want to stand on is good relationships with the socialist bloc. They want good relationships with the Soviet Union. They want good relationships with Eastern Europe and Cuba. And my personal comment is, I think they've had very healthy relationships and that those relationships have been, in general, good for Nicaragua in the context of wanting to stand on four legs. And then they wanted to have good relationships with the non-aligned countries, including Mexico, Venezuela. And in fact, until Mexico's severe economic squeeze, Mexico was providing Nicaragua with most of its oil. So the point of that story is that, yes, there is Soviet involvement in Nicaragua. Yes, there are Cuban military advisors in Nicaragua. But if you use that and you say, aha, look, there's some Cubans there, therefore this is a communist totalitarian state and we've got to get rid of it, that is really problematic. Because what Nicaragua is saying is, we're strongly nationalist, we are not going to sell ourselves out to any people, whether it be the United States or the Soviet Union, we want our independence, and I believe they do. Ironically, I wish, if anybody's interested in this, there's a tape in the library from an earlier presentation called Nicaragua's Economy, The Real Threat. Why is Nicaragua dangerous to the United States? I argue it's because of that it has reoriented its economy to try to meet the needs of the poor, and that's alienated some very powerful forces. So, yes, those influences are there, but again, I would point out something I said earlier. Seven political parties participated in the Nicaraguan elections, including the Communist Party and the Marxist-Leninist Party and the Socialist Party, all of whom pressure the Sandinistas and say, you're a bourgeois revolution, you're protecting the interests of private property. It was the Communist Party and the Marxist-Leninist Party that refused to sign Nicaragua's recent constitution. In other words, I'm trying to appeal to, we've got to have a much broader perspective of what's happening there. We can't just point to some Cuban military advisors and say, okay, we got to get rid of these guys. And further, if you read, if you get a chance to read, or if anybody wants to, check out in the library or get the new edition of my book, The Politics of Compassion. And in there, I have some unbelievable condemnations of the U.S. government, not from the Soviet Union, not from the socialist bloc, but from our Western European allies, basically saying it's the illegal, immoral policy of the United States and Central America that's going to break up the NATO alliance. So, all that is background to that question.
One of the problems we deal with is having the experience of Cuba, where there was tremendous enthusiasm for the revolution in Cuba from the United States at the time, a perception that it was not communist, and then it eventually became communist. So there is a concern there. There is a talk about La Prensa, what's its role. When you characterize, you talk about the diversity, but the only folks you describe are the upper middle class capitalists and the former, you know, the former members of the National Guard. So it's hard to tell. I guess from the point of my point of view, regardless of the situation, the United States is not going to control it. And it's out of our control, and the Contras is a dead end. What's more important really is El Salvador, where we still have a significant impact and role. And I'd be interested in your comparison of the military opposition in El Salvador in terms of its ideological point of view, its long-term objectives compared to the Sandinistas.
Okay, do you want to try that one first for me? I'll be glad to comment. Who makes up the military opposition in El Salvador? What are their goals?
Well, that's a good question.
And why are they fighting?
Well, they say they're fighting against the communism. And they want to get rid of the communism. But
in El Salvador?
El Salvador.
The opposition?
The opposition.
Yeah.
Okay.
The opposition.
It's like what
they want to know is why is the FMLN fighting?
Yeah. Oh, the FMLN is they are a group of people who come from the campesino. They are really poor people. They come from a really, really poor class. And their goal is to defend the people in El Salvador. It's kind of like having a government coming from the same people in El Salvador. But their goal is to not fight, because it's not what they want, but to let the government know that they want peace. They want to become in one agreement, but in that case, like, the government refused to understand that. So the goal is pretty much really having peace in El Salvador. That's all they ask for. But sometimes they feel forced to fight against the army in order to defend the other people, like in the refugees camps or like Chalatenango, all these places where the army usually is.
Why do they call you communists?
Well, that's a cute word that they use in order to kill you. It's like I'm using the Bible. We have the Latin American Bible. If I'm using the Bible and I'm teaching, I'm going to a Bible study, they say, what you're teaching is communism, instead of saying you're bringing the good news to these people.
But that doesn't make any sense, because anybody that knows we're communist.
But if you say I'm hungry,
it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, in that case, it like,
It's a very, very powerful, and all you have to do is, you hear it all the time here too. I have, again, in the politics of compassion, I have what I call 10 common sense observations about why people are hungry, and one of them is that if you accuse people of being communists, it's easier to kill them or to tolerate their being killed. And anyone in El Salvador who is organizing for any kind of fundamental social change or reordering of priorities is considered a communist and labeled such. That's right. And if you read the biblical message and you see that biblical message is that God does not embrace poverty, but in fact speaks out against it, you're a communist.
I'm prepared to believe that labeling is occurring and that people, including good Christians, are being killed. But that doesn't help us make distinctions, if there are any, between the diversity of groups that are opposed to Duarte or to the military or whatever. And I'm trying to understand in terms of developing my own thinking about El Salvador. My perception of Duarte is that he would like to do more, that he does believe in democracy, that he's constantly under pressure from the military and only partially controls them. So you've got sort of, in that side, you've got diverse forces, the Social Democrats and the whatever. And then on the other side, you've got people out of the field, the guerrillas fighting, and you've got people trying to read the Bible to people. And
There is a broad range.
Where should you go? We say, well, let's just swing our support when we elect a new president to the Liberation Front, and will that...
Let me make a comment and then tell two jokes, and I'll tell you where the jokes come from. The comment is that there is a tremendous amount of diversity in El Salvador in terms of the opposition. You have five different groups, armed groups, that make up the armed rebellion. And they range from fairly hardline Marxists to very strong nationalists, a wide range. A lot of the people who came out of base Christian communities and suffered their repression under the army have joined in the armed struggle as well. Then you have the non-violent organizations, the workers, various labor groups, campesino organizations, student groups. Tremendous increase right now in the bubbling and criticism of the present government demanding changes. And the death squads are, in relation to that growing of the popular movements, the death squads are starting to resurface in El Salvador. My two jokes are these, and they come from the Lutheran bishop in El Salvador. The Lutheran Church is under tremendous persecution in El Salvador. I was just in El Salvador in June, and a couple weeks before I arrived there, the Lutheran Church was taken over, and what they took, what the armed gunmen took was the names of all the contributors, members of the church, and all the people who are their contributors. And I can almost tell you, guarantee what that is taken for. What it's taken for is that those people eventually become the targets of assassination squads in El Salvador as the popular movements build. Okay, the joke comes from the Lutheran bishop, who is the head of the Lutheran Church, who's been working with the refugees who have been affected by this war. And he was asked the question, who runs El Salvador? And he said, I'll answer with two jokes. The first one, there's an airplane, and on the airplane there are three very powerful people. You've got President Reagan, you've got the Pope, and you've got Duarte. Keep in mind, Duarte is the elected president of El Salvador. And the pilot comes running back and says, we're going to crash. One of the engines is out, the other one's going, we're definitely going down, and the bad news is we've got one parachute. So who gets the parachute? President Reagan leaps to his feet and says, it's mine, I'm the leader of the free world. The free world can't possibly survive without me. The Pope leaps up and says, no, it's mine, I'm the leader of hundreds of millions of Catholics around the world. The church will fall apart without me. And Duarte sits there very calmly and says, gentlemen, let's solve this in a civilized way. Let's have elections. And so they have elections and the vote comes in and Ronald Reagan gets one vote and the Pope gets one vote. And President Duarte gets 20 votes. And Ronald Reagan gets the parachute. Okay. Second joke. It's a much shorter joke. Keep in mind, this is a Lutheran bishop. Says, why is the United States the only country in the world that has not had a coup d'etat, meaning the military taking control from a civilian government? Answer, it's the only country in the world without a U.S. embassy. Now, the point I'm trying to make is here, that's who runs El Salvador. I don't know what Duarte wants, but almost no one of an independent mind in El Salvador believes that Duarte has any power at all. Who runs the government? The U.S. embassy, the military, and Duarte is a very distant third. Because of that, and because of the kind of imposition of policies of the U.S., it's giving rise to tremendous social turmoil in El Salvador among very broad ranges of sectors, including some that are tied with a Marxist ideology, many of whom are not.
But I think specifically for your question, I don't think we should necessarily write our congresspeople and our senators and the president and say, Dear President Reagan, I think we should shift all of our funds over to the FMLN that we're giving the government. I don't think that, and that's not what Jack's saying. I think what we need to do is say, we're concerned that our tax dollars are being sent to this country, isn't it $1.5 million a day or something like that? That's over $500 million are going to El Salvador every year, and the largest chunk of that is going to the military. We're concerned that our tax dollars are going to the military in El Salvador to basically have a war against its people. What we would like is that military aid be stopped. And as far as I'm concerned, the economic aid oftentimes and probably for the most part feeds into that. So what I would suggest is that we say that aid should stop. Let's see what happens in that country. If some peaceful things start developing, well, then maybe at some point we could start giving economic aid in order to rebuild a country that's very, very poor. But at this point, that seems like something we could suggest rather than shifting our
Mark,
money.
Mark, you've had your hand up for a long time.
I'd also like to help answer Jim because it's a very important question. I think most of the people who are up in the mountains fighting are the brothers and the sisters of those who have been killed by the death squads. I know that if my brother and I were out working to help the poor and all of a sudden my brother got it and there's a white hand painted on my door, I wouldn't be hanging around, and I think my pacifism would get lost pretty quick. I'm sorry to say that, but it's true. And I'd be up in the mountains. Now, who would I join? And I think that's a real important question for us to think about as Americans and how we want Central America to go in the future. If I'm up in the mountains and I'm a peasant, I'm looking around and listening to things, and I'm told that the gun that was used bullet that was used to kill my brother was bought by the people of the United States, sent by the United States government. And I'm told that if we can just get our revolution going a little further, we might be able to get some guns from the Cubans or from the Russians. Where do you think my allegiance is going to start to follow? And if I'm told that the current system of economics in which we were starving is capitalism, and I'm told that if we want to have land reform, that's communism, where do you think I'm going to call myself? And I think we need to realize that we don't not only need to pull back our economic age and stop supporting the group that's currently in power, we need to start having some diplomatic relations with the other side, because sooner or later, they might come into power. And if so, it'd be kind of nice if we were the good guys, for just once.
I don't know of anyone in El Salvador that I have met in the last few years that I've been going there that thinks that a military victory is possible by either the FMLN or by the Salvadoran military forces. The only power in the region that is pushing for a military solution is the United States of America. And the same analogy can be made with Nicaragua. If we're concerned about Cuban involvement, the Contador peace process would have every Cuban military advisor go home. It would have every U.S. military advisor go home. It would prevent the importation of offensive weapons. It would reduce the size of armies. Who's blocked the Contador peace process? It's not Nicaragua, it's the United States of America. There are options there, but what we're lacking in this country is the political will to, in fact, look for negotiated settlements that will allow for internal changes within those countries.
But isn't the Soviet Union pumping money in also?
What's that?
Isn't the Soviet Union also pumping money in there?
The Soviet Union is the principal military supplier for the Nicaraguan government, helping to ensure it to survive this onslaught.
Jack?
Luisa,
no,
did you want
to? Tom has his hand up.
He's
got
his hand up.
Right, go ahead.
Pardon me, but there's something I'd really like to say. And I'd love to talk about politics of El Salvador. I know something about it. I'd love to talk about the politics of Nicaragua. I know something about that. I also know something about what happened within our State Department when the Jewish people were refused entry in our country. We've forgotten that. Nobody wants to own any part of that. We turned our backs. Many of us are alive looking around at some gray heads. We were there. We looked the other way. So what I want to talk about, we've got three topics up, and what I'm particularly anxious to talk about is sanctuary, and I'm a little protective of Luisa, who is 18 years old. And when she says the Monsignor, did you all get it, the Monsignor?
That's Archbishop Romero. That's the martyr. That's the man who was killed saying mass, holding up the sacred species. A gun went off and a bullet went through his brain. Romero was very close with this family. Very close. And you know what they were doing? They were out with the Bible we're so anxious to work with here every day. That's what they were doing. And they were talking about what the Bible means. And these people found some hope in the good news. And the Archbishop, who had come from a different caste, with a different background, had been swayed. And he had seen the light. And a great, marvelous revolution, the sort of thing that we dream about as Christians, was taking place down there. I suppose you could find a communist if you really hunted for one. But they had very little part in this, folks. Have you ever been in a political argument? Because I'm a liberal, I admit, I have had this happen to me, but you don't have to be a liberal to have this happen to you. Have you ever been in an argument where somebody says, oh, you're a communist? And you know how mad it makes you because, no, you're not a communist. And you can give a dissertation with what's wrong with communism. And you have. And your credentials are clear, but no, you're a communist. Well, what's happened to this young lady is 14-year-old boys have leveled guns at her head when she was carrying the Bible. And they were the army. And they said, you're a communist. They couldn't spell the word. That's the way they insult each other down there. If you're a communist. I'm trying to disprove it. And she tried to show them what the Bible was. That's what she went through. She didn't tell you the whole story about her father, about the gory stuff, and I don't want her. She's been through enough trauma. But the main thing I want to say to you is what I know about El Salvador, I did not learn from this family. Do you know what? When they came here, Luisa's two older brothers, her older sister, her younger brothers and sisters, two nephews and one niece, and her mother, God love her, her mother, when she came to us, she nor anybody else said boo about politics. She didn't know about politics. She didn't care about communism. She came to tell us about, she says, I didn't come for protection. I came for witness. And she's the one who talks to us about forgiveness. And we get so damn mad, some of us like to get burp guns and go down there and get those guys. And it's Tránsito who is saying that's not the Christian message. So I don't know about, and on the one topic I really would like to have everybody clear about, our experience with Sanctuary has been as close to the Bible values as anything I've ever known. The political implications are there, but I leave you with the thought of the nun who is standing before the bar of justice. The judge says, you're guilty. Sanctuary. She says, of what am I guilty of? And he says, mercy, with intent to embarrass. And I think this is what the Sanctuary thing, my experience has been, it's been a Christian witness in a real, authentic sense. We haven't heard politics from Lisa or her family, but we've heard about justice and about the loving God.
Lisa wants to add something.
One addition of what he was saying. Yeah, and talking about the FMLN, see, these people, if you go to talk to them about going fight against other people just because they came and took your family away and killed them, the answer is, let's get together and forgive one another. But what's the answer here? Well, you'll die. Why? Because you're talking about forgiving, so you're a communist. And this is the reason why we came here. We didn't come to ask you to fight with us. We ask you to give us support, not to feel sorry for us, but to give us support in knowing.